Well, we can open up to Revelation. Revelation 18 is where we are tonight. And as the song we just sang, "Oh, Worship the King," that's exactly what is not happening in what we've been seeing through this part of Revelation. Remember, chapter 18 is still part of the seventh bowl judgment. And it focuses on Babylon, both chapter 17 and 18 both focus on Babylon, even part of 19 where it's rejoicing over the fall of Babylon. But in chapter 17 we saw that the emphasis was on the religious Babylon, the spiritual Babylon, the mother of harlots, the abominations of the earth. And we have to be careful not to confuse the woman with the city. They're two separate entities, but the woman is what drives this entire system, and is we see that she rides the system of the beast, the political economic system. So this religious Babylon, we saw that the common thread that runs through it, because remember that this religious system has dominated all the major world empires. The beast, he had the seven heads. We saw that those were seven major world empires throughout history. You had Egypt, then you had Assyria, then Babylon, then Medes and Persians, and the Greeks, then the Romans, and last of all, the kingdom of the Antichrist, the last major world power. But the common thread that ran through all of these, because all of them had different religions, but the common thread was that man is ultimate. It was the idolatry of self. And you just think, in so many of these pagan, in Egypt, Pharaoh was a god, and they worshipped Pharaoh. Same in Rome. It was emperor worship with Caesar. Nebuchadnezzar, many of the kings of Babylon set themselves up as gods. They were to be worshipped. Certainly the Medes and the Persians set themselves up as gods, and even in their laws, if a king made an edict or wrote a law, it was inviolable. You could never be changed. And so this common thread, this Babylonian religious system that started all the way back in Genesis chapter 11, where man wanted to make a name for himself, is this idolatry of self, this concept of human perfectibility. Now, this is what drives evolution, right? We're getting better and better and better. I mean, that's evolution. Things go from primitive to more advanced. So man is getting better and better, and ultimately he'll reach a state of perfectibility or almost perfectibility. Culture will get better. Humanity will get better. It's all focusing on human achievement. And we just see this doubt outplayed throughout history. All wars, whenever there's a conflict, whether it's on a personal level or international level, between individuals or between nations, the result of conflict is always self-interest. It's always self-interest. Satan pursues his self-interest. And there's even this concept of self-salvation, all forms of self-salvation. The fundamental principle of all false religion is this concept, again, that man is ultimate. And that expresses itself in two separate ways. Negatively, it can express itself in the denial of the true God and the necessity of grace alone for salvation. And positively, it expresses itself in the belief that man can, by his own power, by his own wisdom, achieve his own salvation. Usually, it expresses itself through some type of ritual, or it can express itself through ethical standards or morality. But whether it's through ritual or through morality and ethics, it's all self-salvation. There's only two religions in the world. Again, the religion of divine accomplishment or the religion of human achievement. Man accomplishing his own salvation. Man is his own Savior. He's emancipated himself from God and the dominion of God. And this is the religious Babylon that's dominated the world. It's dominated it since the fall. And it continues to dominate it today. It dominates all world empires. Just think of the Soviet Union. Based on atheism, based on the total rejection of God, it was all about man. Man creating this utopian environment. That's the beast. I mean, that's the harlotry, the spiritual harlotry. And expresses itself in so many ways throughout history. Well, we saw in 17 that the beast and the ten kings turn on and destroy the woman, this spiritually adulterous, this system of harlotry, of spiritual harlotry. They turn on her and destroy her. Why? Because the beast is not going to tolerate any competition. He sets himself up in the temple as the only object of worship. And he tolerates this man worship for a while until he has consolidated his power. These ten kings give his authority to him. But once he's consolidated his power, he broaches no competitors. Now in chapter 18, John is going to show a new aspect of Babylon's fall. And it's going to be the destruction of the economic prosperity. We saw the destruction of the religious aspect of Babylon. Now we're seeing the destruction of the economic aspect. And chapter 18 can be divided into three sections. There's verses 1 through 3, which is an announcement of Babylon's fall by the angelic being. Then verses 4 through 20 are a prediction of Babylon's fall by a voice from heaven. And then verses 21 through 24 are a second angelic announcement of Babylon's fall. So the first section, verses 1 through 3, is an announcement of Babylon's fall by this angelic being. Second section, verses 4 through 20, are a prediction of Babylon's fall by the voice from heaven. And verses 21 through 24 are a second angelic announcement of Babylon's fall, Babylon's judgment. Tonight we're probably only going to get through the first three verses, the first section. So I'll just go ahead and read those. After these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illumined with his glory. And he cried out with a mighty voice, saying, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great, and she has become a dwelling place of demons, and a prison of every unclean spirit, and a prison of every unclean and hateful bird. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the passion of her immorality, and the kings of the earth have committed acts of immorality with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich by the wealth of her sensuality." So John begins this section by talking about this other angel, another angel. He says, he begins with "after these things." Now, if you remember, as we studied Revelation, that phrase, metatauta, after these things, is always referring to something that comes next in a sequence. And it's usually referring to something new. Many times it's referring to a new vision. But here, it's referring to new circumstances. After these things, I saw another angel. What's new in chapter 18? What's new apart from chapter 17? Well, it's the same physical city, Babylon, that we're dealing with. And this Babylon that we're seeing in chapter 18 is guilty of much of the same as what we saw in chapter 17. In verse 2 of 17, we see the kings of the earth commit acts of immorality. Those who dwell on the earth may drunk with the wine of her immorality. We just read that in verse 3 of chapter 18. We see that she's corrupting the world. She's corrupting the nations. So she's guilty of the same as Babylon in chapter 17. But it's a new aspect of the city that we're looking at. It's the same city, just looking at it from a different aspect. In chapter 17, the guilt of the city is from the spiritual adultery, the abominations, the immoralities that she's promoting and that are a consequence or a result of this type of idolatry, this man-centered, man-focused worship. For in chapter 18, her guilt is from this sensual association with wealth, with luxury. And she even has an attitude of arrogance. You know, in verse 7, it says that she glorified herself. There's just a real attitude of arrogance. So there's a distinction. The distinction that exists here between 17 and 18 is the distinction between two systems, two programs, one spiritual, one political and economic. But they both exist within the same city, within the same geographical city. Again, we've talked about what this is more than likely, literal Babylon, Babylon on the Euphrates. When we get into chapter 18 a little more, we see all the economic activity that's going place, the shipping and the merchants that are coming and going. Well, this fits Babylon on the Euphrates because that's where a lot of shipping activity. Babylon on the Euphrates was a center of a tremendous amount of trade in its heyday because it not only wasn't the intersection of major overland trading routes, but it was also a center of commerce because of all the shipping that was going up and down the Euphrates. So this is what we're seeing here. This is what's new about chapter 18. After these things, I saw another angel. Both of them act, both of these systems act in opposition. Again, just like all false religion, it's acting negatively. It's in opposition to God, denying the need for grace. And it's acting in the positive aspect of man-centered religion in that it's acting independently. It sees no need for God. Man is ultimate. And so what we're going to see here in chapter 18, it marks the internal collapse of the beast empire. You know, when you think about just all the world empires that have existed in the past, even more recently, you know, the Soviet Union, for example, Nazi Germany, Mussolini, you know, Japan, most of these empires tend to collapse from within before they ever collapse from without. Soviet Union certainly collapsed from within before it collapsed from without. We're seeing the disintegration of the United States right now, not so much from an enemy without, but from within. It's weak, and it's weak from within because of its moral collapse, a spiritual collapse. And so these nations, these kingdoms, have always collapsed from within before they've collapsed from without. And that's what we're seeing here, even among the beast kingdom. It's collapsed spiritually, it's collapsing economically. So John writes, after these things, it's introducing a new aspect of Babylon, the economic aspect. John saw another angel. So this is not one of the seven angels. It's not the angel that he saw previously in chapter 17, verse 1. That was one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls. This is another angel. It's different from the angels that had the seven bowls. Well, who is it? Who is it? Well, some have tried to say, based on the description of the angel, coming down from heaven, having great authority, the earth was illumined with His glory. Some have tried to say that this is Jesus. And many commentators will allude to this as Jesus, or even identify this as Jesus. But really, that is so degrading to the deity of Jesus. Jesus is not another angel. There's no way Jesus can be described as another angel. An angel is a created being. Jesus is not a created being. All John is saying here is that he saw another, allos, another of the same kind, another of the same type. Again, there's two Greek words for another. One is another of the same kind, another of a different kind or different class. Here we're seeing another of the same kind, the same class, is the angel that spoke to John previously, one of the seven bowl angels. He came with great authority. Now, what is this authority that he has? Well, probably the authority is probably connected with his ability in verse 2 to cry out with a mighty voice. In other words, to make himself heard, to make himself known. And he did this to make himself known over the competing voice of Babylon. God wants His people to worship Him and Him alone. But there's so many competing voices out there. Remember, Jesus even told a parable, didn't He? Parable of the sower. All the competition that's competing for people's hearts, people's minds. You know, there's people that make professions of faith. But either persecution arises, or the deceitfulness of riches comes about and chokes the word. All sorts of competing voices out there. So this angel is having great authority, crying out with a loud voice, so he can make himself heard over the competing voice of this false religious system, Babylon. And this angel had quite an effect on the earth. The earth was illumined with his glory. Now, the word illumined there can also mean understood, or to understand, to have your intellect and your reason illumined, enlightened. And it could have this connotation here, but the fact that it says the earth was illumined with His glory, we're looking more at some type of brightness, a physical light that is being made visible to the people on the earth. Kind of like Moses' face when he came down from Mount Sinai, and he had to wear a veil over his face because his face was shining from the glory of the Lord because he'd been in the presence of God. Well, here we have an angel coming down out of heaven who's been in the presence of God and is just radiant, resplendent with His glory. We see in chapter 21, verse 23, there's a description of the glory that's going to illumine the earth. The city has no need of the sun or the moon to shine upon it. This is the New Jerusalem, for the glory of God has illumined it, and its lamp is the Lamb. So here we see this angel coming down in this brilliance, and he cried out with a mighty voice, or a strong voice. Now this is real similar to what we see over in verse 8 of chapter 14. Another angel, a second one, following, saying, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She who has made all the nations drink of the wine of the passions of her immorality." Very similar announcement. "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She's become a dwelling place of demons and a prison of every unclean spirit and a prison of every unclean and hateful bird." So he's crying out with this mighty strong voice. In other words, it's impossible to ignore his message. Now in this pronouncement here of judgment, announcement of judgment, there is some strong allusion to some Old Testament passages concerning the nation of Babylon. Let's just look at a couple of those. There's Isaiah. We don't have time to look at all of them, but we can look at a couple of them. Isaiah 13. In Isaiah 13, beginning in verse 17. Now, somewhat unique about Isaiah's, in the book of Isaiah and Isaiah's writing, is Isaiah has a habit of mixing near prophecy with far prophecy. He can be speaking about a near prophecy in one verse and then change to a far prophecy even in the middle of the verse or at the end of the verse. Just to give you an example of this, remember in Luke when Jesus stood up and read in the synagogue, he read from the book of Isaiah, and he read from Isaiah 61. And you don't have to turn there, I'll just read it. It says, "The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me to bring good news to the afflicted. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to captives, and freedom to prisoners, and to proclaim the favorable year of the Lord." And Jesus closed the book and sat down and said, "This is prophecy has been fulfilled in your hearing today." Well, Jesus stopped in the middle of the verse, because the next line says, and the day of vengeance of our God. Well, that hasn't come yet. That's far prophecy when Jesus comes in vengeance. The near prophecy was speaking of His first. So you see how Isaiah does this. Well, he does this over in chapter 13 as well. Verses 17 and 18 are near prophecy concerning Babylon. Behold, I'm going to stir up the Medes against them, who will not value silver or take pleasure in gold, and their bows will mow down the young men. They will not even have compassion on the fruit of the womb, nor will their eye pity children. This is talking about the Medes and Persians coming in and defeating the Babylonians. The Babylonians were defeated in 539 B.C. But now Isaiah switches to far prophecy. And the only way you know the far from the near is what's been fulfilled and what hasn't been fulfilled. Verse 19 says, in Babylon, the beauty of the kingdoms, the glory of the Chaldeans' pride, will be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. It will never be inhabited or lived in from generation to generation. Nor will the Arab pitch his tent there, nor will shepherds make their flocks lie down there. But desert creatures will lie down there. Their houses will be full of owls. Ostriches also will live there, and shaggy goats. And it's interesting, in the Greek version of the Old Testament, the Septuagint translates that word shaggy goats as demons will frolic there. Then hyenas will howl in their fortified towers, and jackals in their luxurious palaces. So there's this near prophecy of Babylon's destruction by the Medes, but then there's this far prophecy of total, complete annihilation, just like Sodom and Gomorrah. Wiped off the map. No trace left. And sudden destruction. Sudden destruction. Turn one more place over in Jeremiah. Jeremiah 50 and 51, both are, the entire chapter deal with Babylon's defeat and desolation. But in chapter 50, verse 46, Isaiah writes, at the shout, Babylon has been seized. The earth is shaken and an outcry is heard among the nations. And he tells us in verse 39 of chapter 50, the desert creatures will live there along with the jackals. Ostriches will live in it. It will never again be inhabited or dwelt in from generation to generation as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. And then in chapter 51, verse 6, flee from the midst of Babylon, and each of you save his life. Well, this is the same thing John writes in verse 4 of chapter 18. I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people. So Isaiah is saying, flee from the midst of Babylon. Each one of you save his life. Jeremiah, chapter verse 6, chapter 51. And then verse 7, Babylon has been a golden cup in the hand of the Lord, intoxicating all the earth. The nations have drunk of her wine. Therefore, the nations are going mad. Suddenly, Babylon has fallen and been broken. Wail over her. Bring balm for her pain. Perhaps she may be healed. So we see this, it's again, this drunken stupor, this intoxication. But it's all in the hand of the Lord. This is what John's referring to here in chapter 18 of Revelation. Now, this first announcement here gives two fundamental reasons for God's judgment of the city. Actually, the first announcement that's here in verses 1 through 3, as well as the second announcement that we see in verses 21 through 24, both of them repeat it. They repeat these two fundamental reasons for God's judgment of the city. The first is her political self-interest, and the second is just her economic self-interest, materialistic self-interest. These always go hand in hand, don't they? political self-interest and economic self-interest. Every nation, every people out there works in their own self-interest. Whenever you have wars, it's because a nation is trying to get something that somebody else has. It's everybody's working within their own self-interest. So this angel's announcement, again, is very reflective, very similar to what he announced over in chapter 14, verse 8. What we see in Isaiah and Jeremiah. Now again, ancient Babylon fell in 539 B.C. Because many people want to say, well, this is true today. This has already been fulfilled. Nobody's living in Babylon. Babylon's a total ruin and a desolation. That's right, it is. But why is it that way? See, Babylon, the literal city of Babylon, has never experienced the total devastation that's described in the Old Testament and that's prophesied in the Old Testament. The present ruin of Babylon is a result of slow decay, right? That's why we call them ruins, because they got ruined. Nobody took care of them. It's just a matter of slow decay. You go to the ancient cities of Greece, it's the same today. They're in ruins. Why? Not because of a total devastation from an army that's just come in and wiped them off the map. No, it's from slow decay. It's not a sudden cataclysmic destruction like Sodom and Gomorrah. There's always been a site or a city on the site of Babylon in one form or another for years. After it was captured by the Medes and the Persians, it was an important religious center. Even during the time of the Greeks and the Romans, it was an important religious center. It was only abandoned during the early history of the church. Up until that time, it had been occupied as a city in one shape, form, or another. But the Old Testament prophecy says nobody's ever going to live there again. It's going to be a haunt of jackals. So here, obviously, Babylon is going to rise to its greatest prominence sometime in the future, both religiously and economically. We're told she has become a dwelling place of demons. This is just a way, again, of showing complete annihilation. It's going to vanish. It's not going to be there. It's like Sodom and Gomorrah. It's a dwelling place of demons. It's also a prison. A prison of every unclean spirit. Now the word prison here is really from the root to watch or to have a watchtower or to guard. In other words, this is a place of banishment now. Place of banishment for the unclean spirits. And because it's called a prison, you know they're here involuntarily. But they're here, they're being kept safe. They're being watched for their time of ultimate judgment. This is where they're confined to. And of every unclean spirit and a prison of every unclean and hateful bird. Again, we just read this. Isaiah mentions ostriches. And other birds. He mentions hyenas, jackals, and so on. The thing that many of these have in common is most of them are scavengers. They're unclean. They eat dead stuff. They're scavengers. But again, what we have here is just a picture of total and complete annihilation, total and complete devastation, just like Sodom and Gomorrah. That's what Isaiah, that's what Jeremiah compares it to. A sudden, absolute, complete destruction. Well, verse 3 tells us the reason or the cause of the city's fall. That's what the first word is, for. Because. It's the reason for the fall. Because all the nations are drunk of the wine of the passion of her immorality, and the kings of the earth have committed acts of immorality with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich by the wealth of her sensuality. So you have three groups. Here they're being impacted by economic Babylon. There's the nations, the ethnos, where we get our word ethnic group from. In other words, everybody in the world. Everybody in the world. There's the kings of the earth. All the rulers, all the powers have been impacted. And the merchants. All the business people. I mean, this is just another way of saying everybody, without exception, has been corrupted by this system. Everybody. Everybody has united with Babylon. This Babylonian system, not only the religious system, but the economic system. It is an ungodly union. All of mankind is spiritually and morally bankrupt. They are identifying with an anti-God, pro-man system. Notice John says, "For all the nations have drunk." Now that's in the perfect tense. And the perfect tense indicates an action that occurred in the past with results that continue up to the present time of the writer. In other words, they imbibed with Babylon. They bought into that system at a time in the past. And the results of that have continued right up until the time of the fulfillment of this prophecy. They've drunk of the wine of the passion. Now, the word passion really means anger or wrath. And some Bibles even have a little footnote at the end of this verse, an alternate translation for passion that says wrath. So they've drunk of the wrath of her immorality. So her immorality involves wrath. What's going on here? All the nations, all the individuals, all the people have bought into this system. Well, they've just been intoxicated by the economic prosperity, this passionate luxury and materialism has just intoxicated all the peoples. And I think we can see an important spiritual principle in here that's repeated throughout the Bible. And that is that economic prosperity is not necessarily a sign of God's blessing. In fact, more often than not, it is a sign of God's judgment, not a sign of blessing. Again, just think of the parable of the sower. Riches come along and do what? They choke the word. They choke the word and it becomes unfruitful. What about the rich young ruler that came to Jesus and Jesus' response to him? It's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle. And he was speaking of a literal eye of a needle, not a gate in a wall. It's easier for a camel to go through the eye of the needle for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. Just apply it to today. Just look at the spiritual condition of the church today versus the economic condition of the church today. The church in America, at least today, is probably at the most prosperous time in the entire history of the Church of America. The church, for the most part, is rolling in money. I read a statistic released recently that churches spend $140 billion a year just on their buildings. Just on buildings in this country. Maintenance, new construction, $140 billion a year on buildings. Remember the church in Laodicea? We have become rich and have need of nothing. We're self-sufficient. We're just fine. But Jesus said, you don't know, you're blind, you're naked, you're poor. You're not Christians. You think you are, but you're not. You've been blinded by your prosperity. You've been intoxicated by your prosperity. You've become self-sufficient. You've been intoxicated into the state where you no longer depend on God. There's no longer dependence. You're self-sufficient. You're autonomous. You're independent. We're okay. See, this is the delusion that I believe much of the church today finds itself in. We're okay. We're fine. Look how God's blessed us. We have these big buildings. We have all this other stuff. We've got to be doing something right. Otherwise, God wouldn't be giving us all this, right? Wrong. It can lead to a spiritual delusion, a spiritual darkening, an intoxication, a self-sufficiency, where they become drunk. And it leads to the immorality of idolatry, self-worship. How much of what goes on in the church is geared toward people? Relevance has taken the place of reverence. Entertainment has taken the place of exaltation and edification. Pomp has taken the place of purity within the church. It's all about the show. It's all about the entertainment. You know, we were talking a day or two ago how, when I've been teaching through John, and Jesus is speaking to Nicodemus and telling him of the need to be born again. In other words, the Jews, Nicodemus, had this mindset that doing equaled being. If we're doing all the right stuff, then we must be this. If we're doing all the Christian stuff, we must be Christians. And it's such a self-deception, because it's all man-centered. It's all man-centered. It's based on what you can do. Whereas Jesus says, no, you have to be before you can do. You have to be born again. So again, when we apply that to the church today, if doing equaled being, we should have the most literate, biblically literate generation in the history of the church. Because there's so much activity going on in the church today, isn't it? We probably have more activity going on in the church today than any time in the history of the church. There's programs galore. There is activities. There's trips. You name it, the church is doing it. All this activity. But yet, we have the highest rate of biblical illiteracy in the church since the Dark Ages. So doing does not translate into being. There's this self-deception, and the self-deception leads to self-worship. And it's so subtle, and it creeps in, and it takes over. And here all the nations have drunk of the wine of the passion of her immorality. They've been sucked into this system willingly, because it elevates man's pride. And the kings of the earth have committed immorality with her. Remember, Jesus warned in Revelation chapter 2, in verse 14, he warned the church in Pergamum that some held the teaching of Balaam, who kept teaching Balak to put a stumbling block before the sons of Israel, to eat things sacrificed to idols, to commit acts of immorality. Now, it's not talking about necessarily just blatant sexual immorality. To eat things sacrificed to idols. In other words, we're compromising with the culture. We're compromising with the culture. We're allowing the culture to dictate what should be taking place within the church. And when that happens, you're committing an act of immorality. That is spiritual adultery. And then in Thyatira, chapter 2, verse 20, I have this against you, that you tolerate the woman Jezebel, calls herself a prophetess, and she teaches and leads my bondservants astray, so that they commit acts of immorality, eat things sacrificed to idols. Yeah, a lot of pagan worship involved acts of immorality. But it wasn't the acts themselves that was the immorality. It was the spiritual adultery that goes along with it. She was leading the people astray. And this is what the kings are doing. They're committing immorality. In other words, they're compromising with this pagan culture. They're seeking political favors. They're seeking economic favors. And in order to do so, they adopt this system that is in opposition to God and puts man at the center. There's a great illustration of this over in 2 Kings. Turn over to 2 Kings chapter 16. 2 Kings 16, we have Ahaz, who's king of Judah at this time. And the kings of the northern kingdom, kings of Israel, come and besiege Jerusalem, wage war against Jerusalem. So what does Ahaz do? Well, Ahaz runs to Assyria. He takes all the gold out of the, and silver out of the temple, goes off and pays off the king of Assyria to come and be his mercenary, essentially, to come and attack the northern kingdom to take care of the kings of Israel that are against him. And so in verse 10, King Ahaz goes up to thank Tiglath-Pileser, the king of Assyria. Says Ahaz went to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria. And what did he do? He saw the altar which was at Damascus. And King Ahaz sent to Uriah the priest the pattern of the altar and its model according to all its workmanship. So Uriah the priest built an altar according to all that King Ahaz has sent from Damascus and made it before the coming of Ahaz. And when the king came from Damascus, the king saw the altar. And the king approached it. And he went up to it and burned his burnt offerings, his meal offerings. And then if we keep reading, we see he even put it in the temple. See, he walks up to Damascus. Wow, this is a great looking altar. I want one just like it. Has it made, sent back. He adopts all for the sake of political advantage, all for the sake of economic and political favors. Hey, we can look like them. We can do like them. And we'll be good in there. We'll ingratiate ourselves to them. Well, we can think of a perfectly good example just happened here not too long ago. Our president goes to Islamic countries and says America is not a Christian nation. Well, it's true. It's not. But it goes deeper than just saying that. He is absolutely denying the foundations and the principles on which this nation was built. And why? For the sake of political expediency and economic advantage. Pure and simple. See, you create these ungodly, immoral alliances for political and economic gain. Look at all the trade agreements with China. Why? China uses slave labor. Well, that doesn't matter. We can produce things so much cheaper there. All for political and economic gain. Human suffering is irrelevant. See, this is what the kings of the earth are doing here. Even more so, they've committed acts of immorality with her. Well, the kings of the earth are going to suffer less than the merchants of the earth. The merchants of the earth have become rich by the wealth of her sensuality. See, the kings are going to maintain their political power, but the merchants of the earth are going to lose everything when economic Babylon collapses. The word merchant here literally means a passenger on a ship. And it's just talking about somebody that travels to conduct their business. And these merchants have become rich. How? By the wealth of her sensuality. Literally, that word wealth there is literally power. Dunamis. By the power, by the might of her sensuality. Her insolent luxury. Self-indulgence. Babylon's luxury, her economic prosperity, has power to enrich the merchants. How does this happen? I remember reading about some companies, American companies that went to India, set up some manufacturing plants. Well, India has a very subsistence culture. You know, if they got enough food for that day, they're happy. And if they got paid on Friday and that paycheck would see them for 2 weeks, they wouldn't show up for work for 2 weeks. So they were perfectly content with that. So these companies are thinking, how can we instill in these people the idea that they need to come to work every day? Well, what did they do? They gave everybody in the plant the Sears and Roebuck catalog. And now they start seeing all this stuff that they never had before. Wow, we want this. We want that. We'd like to have this. We'd like to have these things. Well, how do you get those? Well, I've got to go to work, and I've got to start working and working every day so I can afford all this type of stuff. That's how they got them to come to work every day, by instilling in this desire to enrich themselves more, this desire to have more, to accumulate this wealth, to accumulate these things, to accumulate the luxury. I mean, what do we see? Virtually all advertising is selling a self-indulgent lifestyle. Buy it now, pay for it later. It's the self-indulgent lifestyle. It's this idolatry and pride in wealth and luxury and prosperity. See, this is what's going on here. The merchants of the earth become rich by the power, by the attraction, by the might of this luxurious lifestyle. You can have this too. Buy it from us. We can sell it to you. Well, it doesn't take a lot of imagination, because we see this happening so much today. We see it in the church. The church has been so corrupted by the culture today. We see it in our society even more so. And we see it in false religions. Just turn on the television. All false religion is usually connected some way with a promise of wealth and prosperity. Just Benny Hinn, my goodness. And those like him. You know, the Oral and Richard Roberts. It's all the name it, claim it guys. If God wants you to be wealthy and prosperous, it's all false. This promise of wealth and luxury. But here it's going to be happening on a wholesale level. Everybody is going to be into it. And this is what's going to characterize the economic Babylon. It's not only a spiritual self-worship, but that self-worship expresses itself in self-indulgence in the economy and in the political life. Self-interest, political self-interest, economic self-interest. It's all self. All self. And that's the great idolatry that's dominated the world since the fall.